They're fed up with the way things have been run for the past 6 years. They are fed up at being deceived, taxed, overregulated, and most of all, being called stupid. I think they are also concerned about foreign affairs. They worry about their safety, about terrorism, about U.S.'s relationship with its allies and its enemies. Daily, we are besieged with disconcerting news about the Mideast. Even today, there is news of a Palestinian attack on a synagogue in Israel. So it is particularly prescient that today we have a speaker who can enlighten us on this important topic. Before I turn the podium over to Patty to introduce Dr. Safer, I want to just say that it is good to see you all, and I am delighted that we have such a wonderful turnout for our special program today. Just before I introduce Patty, I want to remind you to buy your opportunity tickets from Joyce Thornton. And we have two very special prizes. So I'd like Morgan to describe them briefly, which I think will entice you even more.
Okay. Joyce, do you have, where is Joyce? Lost you again. Do you have the one prize? Okay. So the one, I told you in the newsletter that I went overboard a little bit, overboard a lot, but this prize is a bangle bracelet in Swiss blue topaz. Joyce has it right there in Swiss blue topaz with white topaz. You can lie and tell people they're diamonds because nobody's ever going to know. But there's over 7 1/4 carats in there. And what I usually do is I am up late at night, I get the stuff, and then I go back in and get the description. When I went back in to get the description, the price had gone up by 60%. So I can't do this again, and it's worth $599.99. So buy your tickets. The second one I have a model for. Would my lovely model stand up? This was a surprise.
Ooh.
Okay. Ooh. So these are cultured freshwater pearls, and with real faux diamonds.
Real faux.
And I had a little bitty budget, and when I got this in the mail, I went, I'm not sure I'm going to give this up. But it is beautiful. So if you just walk up and down for a little bit, let them see what you're looking at. I know. She's like, but my legs, and I go, if I had legs like that, I would show them too.
It's entirely on the pearls.
So that's prize number two, and that one is worth $65. So you have almost $700 worth of prizes today for a ticket. And Joyce, would you raise your hand one more time? She'll be selling those in between our, during lunch period. So if you haven't bought your ticket, please do so. It is the November birthstone, if you have anybody that was born in November, and or just likes blue. And it makes great Christmas gift. Thank you.
Bunch of cabalos.
So there's a lot of gentlemen in the audience today, and you are welcome to buy opportunity tickets. And again, the holidays are coming up. Patty has asked me just to remind you to turn off your cell phone if you haven't already. And without further ado, I introduce to you Patty Cook, our first vice president.
Everyone, our speaker today is Dr. Abraham Sofer, and he served as legal advisor to the United States Department of State and was appointed the first George Shultz Distinguished Scholar and Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution in 1994. And for those of you unfamiliar with the Hoover Institution, In 1919, Herbert Hoover pledged $50,000 to set up a Stanford University Hoover Library of War collection. He was a member of the first graduating class of Stanford. In 1957, it was renamed to the Hoover Institution on War, Revolution, and Peace, and that's named holds today. The mission is that the institution must constantly and dynamically point the road to peace, to personal freedom, and to the safeguards of the American system. Dr. Sofar's work has focused on issues related to international law and diplomacy, national security affairs, government regulation, international terrorism, and the Middle East conflict. He's a veteran of the U.S. Air Force, and he received his B.A. magna cum laude in American history and his law degree from New York University School of Law, where he was editor-in-chief of the Law Review. He became a professor of law at Columbia University. In 1985, then Secretary of State Shultz asked Dr. Sofar to become legal advisor to the United States Department of State, a position in which he served from 1985 to 1990. He was principal negotiator in various matters that were successfully resolved, such as assisting Shultz in forcing disclosures that led to the termination of arms dealings in the Iran-Contra affair. Dr. Sofar was also frequently mentioned on President George H.W. Bush's short list of candidates for Supreme Court justice. Dr. Sofar is a descendant of Jewish immigrants from Baghdad, Iraq. They later settled in Rangoon, Burma, and his grandfather built a very successful trading company there, and there remains a building in the city center named Sofar's Building. Dr. Sofar is a founding trustee of the National Museum of Jazz in Harlem. It was founded in 1997. He and his wife have been married 37 years, and they're the parents of six wonderful and accomplished children, four computer scientists, one ornithologist, I'm going to tell you what that is later, and one seller and reader of ancient and other special books. An ornithologist, I had to look it up, is a type of zoologist who studies birds. Last month, his youngest son was honored to become an ensign in the U.S. Navy, and he'll be reporting in December to Charlotte, North Carolina, did I get that right, and working on nuclear subs. As a side note, I suppose no discussion on the Middle East will be without mention of Iran. And I'd like to say that Dee Dee Underhill, who was born and raised in Iran, her guest Kourouz, their guest Janine from Paris, whose husband is Iranian, and she lived in Iran from 1956 to 1979, worked for Shell Oil. And myself, I lived in Iran from 1974 to 1976. I worked for the Imperial Government of Iran in setting up their national communication system. That sounds like a lot to do, but I somehow did it. I mention that because Dee Dee and I, Janine Kourouz, we share a passion for the country of Iran and its citizens. At one point in the not too distant past, Iran had a statistic that 60% of the people in Iran were under the age of 30. These are bright, intelligent people. So there is a compassion for what once was in Iran and what could be. So I'm hoping Dr. Sofar might enlighten us to when that nightmare is going to end. So without further ado, with great pride, I introduce you to Dr. Abraham Sofar. His topic today is Grant Threat to U.S. Security in the Middle East.
She really dug deep. And, to know about the Sofar Building in Rangoon is amazing. Family actually was very proud of that building. It was built in the early part of the last century by my great-grandfather and his sons. And they built a really good business there, which, you know, if it hadn't been for a few things like a bankruptcy and an invasion by Japan and a few other things, I might have been, you know, born rich. But then I wouldn't be as happy as I am today here in America, having made it strictly on the merits. It's just a marvelous country. I immigrated to the United States at the age of 14, and I was a U.S. federal district judge by the age of 40. I'd like to know about any other country in the world that would give a young man or woman that kind of an opportunity. It just doesn't happen. There is nowhere else, anywhere, that people are that open, are that willing to get engaged. And I'm particularly proud, of course, that my son is following me in the U.S. service and is about to become a nuclear engineer on an attack submarine. It takes about a year to do that. You have to learn first how to be a nuclear engineer, and then they let you sit in a submarine for 6 months in the harbor, and then they finally, if the crew approves of you, they take you out. And that's the way it is. It's just a marvelous system where you prove yourself and move ahead. And all the strength we derive from that is at stake in many ways. I think the fact that we're focusing on Iran today makes a lot of sense. The chaos we see in the Middle East is basically in Iraq and Syria more than anywhere else. But the source of it and the reason for it is in Iran. If you stop to think about it, what we are witnessing is a war, a religious war, between the Shiites and the Sunnis that's gone on for hundreds of years, that is being replayed in two of many countries in which Iran has been very active. Syria, we have President Assad, who is a stooge of Iran, who is Iran's selected leader there, and they are actively defending him with particularly a force from Lebanon called Hezbollah, which they have built up since 1983, since the overthrow of the Shah. They've been very active in Lebanon, and today Hezbollah is no longer just a small terrorist organization, but an army with representation in the Lebanese government that gives them a veto over any policy that the Lebanese government might choose to adopt. So we have a situation where Iran's influence in Lebanon was extended to Syria, and Syria had become a bridge, essentially, for the supply of armaments to Hezbollah. And so Hezbollah has lent itself to the cause and is helping defend the Assad regime, which we said that we opposed years ago, but have done virtually nothing to depose. In addition to that, if you stop to think about Iraq, once again, you see the fingerprints of Iran. The situation in Iraq is desperate. It's true. But it's not because the U.S. intervened there. I would personally have favored our leaving Iraq much, much sooner and leaving Afghanistan much, much sooner. But the fact is that what happened there was Maliki became so obviously biased in favor of Iran and the Shiites that the Sunnis gave up on the national government. And they had reason to. If you stop to think about what's happened since ISIS stepped into Iraq, where did the big collapse of the Iraqi army occur? In the Sunni region, in the Sunni Kurdish region of Iraq. And the officer corps of the Iraqi army is essentially Shiite. And they weren't going to hang around and give their lives to defend Sunnis. And of course, you know, you could say they were unprepared, et cetera, et cetera. But look at how well they're doing at defending Baghdad and Karbala. And they are being assisted in Baghdad and the other Shiite cities by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps directly, instead of Hezbollah here, you've got Lebanese Shiites going over to Syria. In Iraq, you've got literally Iranian forces in the south, Baghdad in the south, defending the Shiite population effectively against ISIS. So what do we do about all this chaos? Well, the first thing we do is you understand the source of the chaos. If you don't understand that, you can't fashion policy vis-a-vis Syria or Iraq. And if you do understand it, it becomes pretty clear what our policy should be and that we aren't doing much of what we should be doing. So let me go over that, and I'm going to be relatively short because it's a beautiful day, and I'm between you and lunch. I have no idea. Usually in these talks, you know, you come on after lunch, and people have had a little wine. They're softened up. You're sitting there looking at that golf course. And I'm between you and lunch. Oh, my God. Let me see. So here's what we have to understand about the background about Iran. And there's a book out there that I've written called Taking on Iran. It came out last year. The introduction is by George Shultz, and that alone is worth $20. And it's going to go to, the money goes to the Hoover Institution. There's also a paperback that came out a year earlier, which is not as good, but half the price. So that book tells the story of the relationship between the United States and Iran after the Ayatollah, that is after 1979. And it's characterized by two things. A lack of strength and an unwillingness to engage. This was striking to me because I had the privilege of serving in one of the strongest and most successful administrations in American history. I served under President Reagan and the first President Bush and George Shultz and Jim Baker. I couldn't have been more blessed than to have served such people. And what did we accomplish? Well, I was a small member of that team, but what was accomplished was extraordinary. We confronted the Soviet Union, and we confronted them across the board in every way. We armed their opponents. We went to countries, we went to five different countries and helped people there fight groups that were funded and supported and armed by the Soviet Union. We bled them in Afghanistan. We literally funded the Taliban and the other fighters there who were actually killing Soviet soldiers, and that helped bring the Soviet Union down. We built Star Wars. We started that whole process of arming. We doubled our Navy. We confronted them militarily in the sense that we gave them a sense of hopelessness about the future, given the strength we were demonstrating both economically and militarily. At the same time, we negotiated with them about anything, everything. We condemned their human rights activities. We met with them anywhere. We had meetings at the highest level and at the lowest level. We dealt with every kind of issue. And we called them. We said what we thought of them. President Reagan called them the evil empire. Everyone freaked. I mean, the New York Times, I'm talking about, you know, we were going to cause World War III. Actually, what happened was the president leveled with them. You know, you're the worst system in the world. You're evil. You are going to be part of the trash heap of human history. That's what he had the audacity to say to them. At the same time, he was meeting them everywhere, anywhere, talking to them, willing, being polite, engaged, and not just about arms control, about everything. Why are you keeping those Christian people in our embassy basement? Why won't you let them leave? And he urged them to cooperate with us and to be more responsive about human rights and freedom of religion and all the things we care about. And he succeeded in all that with a combination of strength and diplomacy. And now I'm sitting there as legal advisor, and you know, I've got this little piece of that action and that little piece, and I was doing the sort of, few interesting things, the Danilov affair I handled. That was wonderfully interesting, and it did get Schultz and Shevardnadze engaged. But I'm noticing, above all, that what we're doing with the Soviet Union is completely different from the way we're handling Iran. No negotiation. No pressure. They blow up our marine barracks in Lebanon through Hezbollah, and we do nothing. We leave Lebanon. And then they kill people in Kuwait. American attacked the American ambassador, attacked, and then, I mean, throughout the Reagan administration, I'm not talking about what had happened with Carter, which was bad enough, but I'm talking about Ronald Reagan. And then, of course, the Iran-Contra affair. We swing from refusing to talk to them to talking to them in secret and writing them love letters. I'm going to tell you about love letters. We just had a recent love letter. The fourth love letter written by our president, this president, to the Ayatollah. Well, love letters started early. Carter had the first love letter. He wrote a love letter after they grabbed our embassy people. Oh, we can work this out. Let's just be nice. Don't worry, I'm not going to use force. It really worked. It was so great. Just wonderful. And Ronald Reagan's love letter didn't work any better. It was a catastrophe. Strategically, morally, politically, in every way. And almost brought the presidency down. Luckily, we had George Shultz there, who put an end to it. And it was a rough time. But we succeeded, and thereby reaped the benefits of what we had done with the Soviet Union. But to say that we succeeded with Iran would be absurd. We did not. We sent them all the wrong messages. We let them kill Americans with impunity. We let them kill Iranian people because they were homosexuals or because they were of some cult that was not specifically Shiite. So we let them do all those things without bitterly complaining the way we did about the Soviets. Completely different policy. Completely different. But the love letters continued. The policy difference between the Soviet, how we handled the Soviet Union and Iran continued from that period, 79, 80, all the way to today. All the way to today. There was a brief event in the Persian Gulf, I was proud to be part of it, where they sent some ships out and they were mining the Gulf. They were mining the Gulf. The Iranian Navy, the IRGC Navy, Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Navy. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is a separate organization under the Iranian Constitution that has its own Navy, Air Force. They are in charge of the missile program, and they are told by the Constitution that their purpose is to propagate Islam, to create a successful Shiite empire. That's what they want to do. That is their aim. And the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps is there for that purpose. And they started mining the Gulf. They were firing missiles at ships in the Gulf. And we went in, once we got serious, in a couple of days, we sank half of the IRGC's Navy, which was minuscule, really, shot down a couple of planes, and they ran. And they've never done it again. Never. Never. Not a single mine, not a single missile have they fired since that confrontation. So that's how ineffective force can be. But that was it. That was the only time we actually stood up to them. And I'm going to go very quickly over a couple of very tragic things. And I don't want to minimize how terrible they were. The Khobar Tower bombing, which killed about 18 Air Force, U.S. Air Force personnel and injured over 200, brought down an entire barracks. It just wasn't. They weren't able to get inside the barracks and kill everyone in the building the way they were in Lebanon. They had to blow up the barracks from outside. There was a gate, there was a fence. It wasn't far enough away to prevent the injuries. But so that was in Saudi Arabia, and we knew that it was Iranian-sponsored. The head of the FBI called for a reaction. And the problem was Iran had elected a guy named Khatami, who was a liberal. He wanted to get along with the United States, and he said so. So the Clinton administration adopted a policy that will seem very familiar to you today. The policy was to first write a love letter, because you've got to get a love letter out there, and let them know that you're ready for an affair. And you hope that they are as well. And why not, you know? It's going to be better for both of us. It's a very sweet way to approach things in life, but not so good when it comes to a radical religious regime. But Albright and Clinton were determined to reach out to Khatami. You can't blame them, really. I mean, professionally you could blame them, morally. You can understand why. Here's this guy get elected, then he gets reelected. He's got control of the Majlis, which is their parliament. And he says he wants to be friends. And he means it, everyone. Because, you know, you can tell. The Ayatollah hates him. The IRGC condemns him. And he's still saying pretty positive things about America. So you want to reach out to him, be friendly with him, and you don't do anything about the Khobar Tower bombing. You let all those airmen die in vain. So, what happens? What happens is the IRGC goes in to the Ayatollah and says to the Ayatollah, we don't need to do anything for these Americans. We've got this Khatami guy. We're going to get rid of him soon. We are on a roll. This is the way Iran can succeed. We've got Lebanon. We're going to have Syria. We can win in Iraq. Bahrain is a province of Iran. We're just waiting to take it. Yemen, the government fell just a month, last month, and a Shiite group is apparently going to take over there. So the Ayatollah was told exactly what Clinton did not expect. He thought Khatami would be given more room to engage with us because we had been nice to him. Instead, he was given less because it didn't matter. We were nice to him, and therefore there was no need to be nice to us. Because they have an agenda, and the agenda could be implemented because we were being nice to them rather than being firm with them, rather than responding to them the way we responded to the Soviet Union. And so we lost a great opportunity when we lost the opportunity to engage with Khatami. We meant to engage with him. We meant to make peace with him. Instead, he fell, basically displaced. His place was taken by a radical, who the Ayatollah approved of, and that opportunity was gone. Now we have another opportunity, and I don't demean it. It's a replay. We have Rouhani, we have Zarif. They are well-connected, extremely knowledgeable about the Iranian system. They're just the kind of fixers you want, right? They're the ones who know where the bodies are buried, what to do, how to make things different. They know how to do it. They're the right guys to talk to, the right guys to engage with. But what are we doing? We are being nice to them. I am amazed to discover just this month, that the president has written the fourth secret letter to the Ayatollah. And Susan Rice said, after she was asked, is it true that the president has written a fourth letter to the Ayatollah, making nice, sort of trying to get him to be engaged with us or to give Rouhani and Zarif more room to negotiate on the nuclear problem? Is it true? She did not deny the letter. She said, I don't talk about the president's private letters. It's been a long time since Jefferson used that phrase to talk about his letters to Livingston about Burr. The notion that letters written by the President of the United States to another head of state are private is, something a little bit dated. But that's what she said. And so we don't know exactly what's in the letter, but we can guess. Let's get along. Right? We've got this negotiation. Let's make a deal. It's going to be good for both of us. You don't need a nuclear weapon anyway. You said you don't want one. And we can cooperate with you and ISIS. We're willing to do that. And then, the real interesting comment that says more than anything else. We are attacking ISIS. We are not attacking Assad. And we do not intend to hurt any of Assad's forces. That is a very important statement. And completely inconsistent, incidentally, with the policy that we allegedly adopted 3 years ago, calling for the removal of Assad. So what's Iran's reaction to this? Well, the IRGC is on a roll. They want to win. They have an agenda. And the Ayatollah believes we're liars. I'm convinced he really thinks we're liars and we're evil. And it doesn't help when we tell him we're not out to remove Assad, we're not out to hurt Assad, in a private letter while we're saying, the president is saying to the American public and to the Congress, we're going to give $500 million to a group that we've identified in Syria who is going to continue to work to remove Assad. So what is the Ayatollah going to tell himself when he reads that letter? Oh, these terrible Americans. They just lie. You don't know what they're saying. No, instead of saying, you evil person, you terrible, you have the worst system in the world today. You are killing the Baha'i, you're killing homosexuals. You've executed maybe 1,000 people since the beginning of the year. You're a horrible regime, and you're doomed. You're doomed. And maintaining that position, but being willing to engage and putting maximum pressure, meanwhile, on the IRGC. Instead of doing that, we're pretending. We're pretending. And we're getting nowhere. So what is the policy then? The policy clearly in Syria should be what we said it was, to remove one of the most heinous dictators in the world with as little American blood and losses as possible. But certainly, let's back up our word. Let's at least support the Turks in creating a zone where they can put the over 3 million refugees that have been created by this war. Let's give some greater protection to the moderate groups that we have identified so they could have prevented ISIS from developing in the first place, because that's what ISIS came out of. The fact that the Sunni radicals around the world have been supporting them, whereas we have not been supporting their opponents. And let's keep our word in Syria. And the same thing in Iraq. And in Iraq, we are happily fortunate to have seen Maliki go. And there's a better leadership in Iraq. But it's still a pro-Iranian, pro-Shiite leadership. So what should we be doing in Iraq? Well, clearly, we are doing the right thing by fighting ISIS. And no one disagrees with that in the Sunni world. Everyone agrees. I mean, the Saudis, all our allies, feel that ISIS is a horrible force that we should be fighting. But how can we hurt the IRGC at the same time is the question we should be asking ourselves. Not how can we cooperate with General Soleimani, who now is some kind of hero in the press, even though he was the one who killed with at least 1,000 Americans in Iraq by supplying arms to the Shiite militias. This man that we should have taken out with a rocket a long time ago is someone we should happily see kill ISIS, but we have no need to do everything that he wants us to do. We need to bring pressure on him. And the obvious way to do that is by supporting the Kurds. The Kurds in Iraq desperately need us. They are our best friends in Iraq. And they have created a relatively civilized zone of human activity. They are against the wall, fighting for their lives against this ISIS force. And we are finally beginning to give them some serious armaments. And of course, we've now committed to air cover. And in Kobani, you can see the difference when we come in, even from the air. We We were able to save Kobani, and I think, as I think the chief of staff, General Dempsey, is right that we are turning it around. And if we continue down this path, we will defeat ISIS. And that is good. But on the other hand, let's keep in mind our basic objective is not just to defeat ISIS, but to defeat the IRGC. And therefore, any help we can give the Kurds in establishing strength within Iraq, any help we can give the Kurds to do that will be read by the Ayatollah as hostile to him. Hostile. A threat to him. Because, you know, Iran has its own Kurds. And why not help them? We know how to do that. If you are going to be unfriendly with us and not reach a deal in the nuclear talks, you know, things could happen within Iran that without any Americans on the ground. So there are ways to put pressure on this administration, the Ayatollah and the IRGC, and we're not using them. And what's particularly distressing is that we know how these policies of love letters, diminished sanctions, word games in a negotiation, we know how they fail. We know that with the same government, Iran. We don't even have to look into other analogous kind of historical precedents. We know how this government works. And we know that Rouhani and Zarif, whatever they say, will be helped, not hurt, by our strength. The more strong we are with the Ayatollah and the IRGC, the more leverage Rouhani and Zarif will have with the Ayatollah. Because they will be saying to the Ayatollah, look, this path is not good for us. These guys are tough. They're doing things that are going to hurt us. No love letters. Missiles. Help their enemies. Pressure and moral condemnation is what's called for. Moral condemnation. Someone getting up there and saying what we really believe about those people that are running that theocracy. Instead of pretending to like them and to be able to get along with them in a, you know, real honest way. Of course, Reagan was ready to negotiate with the Soviets, but I'll never forget his speech at the Moscow University when they invited him over, and he stood in front of this huge bust of Karl Marx. And was it one of Marx's buddies? I don't know. Lenin. It was probably Lenin, yeah. The big bust of Lenin right behind his head. And he says to the students, you better find another system to work in, kids. This is not going to work very much longer. You know, don't put too much of your money on this government of yours, because it's going down. And get ready for the new world. Amazing. Right there, telling them that they were doomed, even as he's polite. You know, no pretense. He's genuinely polite. He doesn't want a war. But he's telling them what we think of them. What do we think of killing people who are Baha'i? What do we think of killing homosexuals? Just because they're homosexuals.
What do we think of these things? Treating women the way they treat women. Not what we say in love letters. So, I'm disheartened because it's become clear that the word games that are being played in the nuclear negotiation are doomed. If you look at each issue in the nuclear negotiation, you will see that what we're trying to do is just get a few more months of time between the time they can decide to have a nuclear weapon and the time they will have a nuclear weapon. And I could go through those with you, you know, each of the issues, the amount of enriched uranium, the degree of enrichment, the plants that they've let people see and the plants that they haven't let people see. The International Agency now says that 2 out of the 12 plants that were identified as suspicious, involving probably military activity, that you said we would be allowed to see by September, we still haven't been allowed to see. So that's the context in which these negotiations are going on. And like Kissinger said, when you're dealing with a radical regime, it isn't words that bring about, or discussion that brings about a change in policy. It's a change in the objective situation that the other country sees. It's the change that the Soviet Union saw that was being created for them through a whole set of policies, including their own internal failures. And what have we done? We have reduced the sanctions. We've released approximately $8 billion of frozen assets. We have helped them bridge the period between when they agreed to negotiate and the present. And it looks very much like we are going to be so dependent upon the word game that's going on with the P5 plus one and Iran that there is no way to expect a change in policy from a regime as radical as this one. It's not a very optimistic picture that I paint for you. There is increased pressure on the IRGC that's really almost like brimming up from things that we have very little to do with. The rebels in Syria have brought Hezbollah into the fight, and they're killing a lot of Hezbollah fighters. The fighters in ISIS are actually killing some Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps personnel. This is costing them. There's no question about it. But no thanks to us. And not enough, in all likelihood, to get them to change their basic policy. So, I can tell you, I do not want to mislead you. I did have some hope when we stepped up and started helping the Kurds. If we can continue down that road, it could make a difference. But if our policy is to reach a deal based on words rather than pressure, and a change in policy that pressure brings about, if that's our approach, it's not going to work. In my view, it's not going to work. And we're going to have to hope that the new Congress will step up and stop a process that the president almost clearly does not want to allow the new Congress to get involved in. It's an amazing situation. Here we have a situation that I've described to you that's a potential very bad agreement for the United States and its allies. And the president has not allowed any aspect of this negotiation to reach Congress. Any aspect. The initial deal was called an understanding so that it would not be subject to any legislative review. And a very clear signal has been sent out that they are not going to enter into a treaty. They're not going to call it a treaty. Now, of course, that the Senate is Republican, it's even clearer that there will be an effort to implement a deal with Iran if one is reached. The best outcome right now would be for nothing to be agreed. I favor extending the negotiation. I favor anything short of an agreement, because the agreement that we're likely to get at this stage would be a very adverse one. So with those happy thoughts, you can now resume the excellent wine that's available to you here. You may want to ask some questions, though. Go ahead. Sir.
Yes. Initially, our ally, Turkey, said that they would not allow us to fly missions out there. Would you favor giving a billion to Armenia to build an airstrip there?
Well, I would not look at the Armenia option until I exhausted the effort with Turkey. I think we have gravely disappointed the Turks by not cooperating with them and providing air cover for a region of Syria where they could actually house the hundreds of thousands of Syrians that have flooded across their border. If we care about it, as we do, I mean, as a nation, we're giving more to help the Syrian refugees than any other country in the world, by far. So we do care, and we're helping Jordan. But we should have really looked far more seriously at cooperating with Turkey in this effort. We've become alienated from Turkey to a considerable degree, and that's not all our fault. It's not all our fault. But it's not a good thing to be alienated from the most moderate, most Western-oriented Sunni government in the world. So I would very much like to see that relationship re-strengthened.
Number one, Can't hear you.
Thank you. Do you believe that the development of a Kurdistan, independent and hopefully working with Turkey, is feasible? And secondly, if Iran does develop the nuclear capability, what is to prevent Israel from attacking?
Well, on the Kurdistan question, I think we are right to try to keep Iraq as a sovereign entity with Kurds, Sunnis, and Shia getting along. I think that's the sound policy to begin with. But we are wrong to think that by helping the Kurds, we will be encouraging the division of Iraq. On the contrary, I think helping the Kurds of Iraq will give us more leverage with them, will give us more influence with them. And we can, I think, convince them not to completely break with the government of Iraq. And they will have more negotiating leverage with that Shiite government if we help them. So I very much favor helping the Kurds. I think there is more of a likelihood of a Kurdistan if we don't help the Kurds, because they are, they're determined to somehow protect themselves, and it's inevitable that they'll try to do that. I think the Turkish situation is much more complicated, but that is not, you know, it's not going to result in a Kurdish break from Turkey. That is, on track to actually become a more viable partnership. And what we needed to do was get behind Turkey in that effort much more emphatically. And so we've lost our influence with Turkey. We really have. And that's not a good thing, because they are a really powerful and potentially constructive force in the Middle East. Yes, ma'am.
You have not mentioned Saudi Arabia's role in the Middle East. Personally, I think it's one of the worst countries in the world. So, because they fund everything. So, what is your opinion on Saudi Arabia?
Well, the Saudis, you know, support our efforts against ISIS, and that's good, even though they're Sunnis. The problem with the Saudis has been that the Saudi princes are so wealthy, there are so many of them, and there is a lot of support by some of them for the most extreme kinds of Salafist activity. And of course, Qatar has been even worse than the Saudi princes in this last round. So yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear that we have to deal with the fact that the Saudis do things, and certainly some Saudis do things that are not going to be helpful to us. But they are a serious and important ally of the United States, and we need to work with them and figure out. You know, they have lost confidence in us vis-a-vis Iran. And what the consequence of an Iranian nuclear weapon will be a Saudi nuclear weapon. And that's one of the things. So if you don't like what the Saudis are doing now, just don't give them a weapon. You know, if they have a nuclear weapon, you could just, you know, you can imagine what's going to happen, what the Middle East is going to be like if we have a Turkey, Saudi Arabia, maybe Kuwait, other countries adopting the same policy. Yes, ma'am.
It's not a fair before lunch question, but what about Israel and all this?
What about Israel and all this? Well, Israelis are very unhappy about what's going on in the negotiation, and justly so. I think if we had been firmer, if we were more firm with the IRGC, and we were actually trying to convince Iran to change its policy vis-a-vis nuclear weapons, as opposed to getting 3 months or 6 months more of time. I'll give you an example. We started negotiation by wanting them to shut down Fordo, the military installation that they have in the mountain near Qum. We now have accepted Fordo with inspections, but the inspections could be stopped. I mean, we wanted them to have no more than 4,000 instruments to change, you know, to enrich uranium. And we have now come up with the idea that they will keep all of their 18,000 and will just disconnect, we'll take away the pipes for 15,000 of them. So, I mean, pipes, they can find pipes, you know. They found them once, they can find them again. So the Israelis are particularly concerned about Iraq, which is a heavy water nuclear plant, which produces plutonium. So plutonium is a different route to a bomb than uranium. I'm sure you guys are going to love me for this talk, you know. Oh, God. But, you know, I really am a positive person.
It's sad, isn't it?
But the fact is that Iraq is... Iraq could be made into a light water plant rather than a heavy water plant.
and we could avoid this plutonium problem. But the word is that somehow we're going to have a modified heavy water plant which will have less plutonium produced. And so if, see, the interim agreement, this is why we have to convince them to change their policy, not to argue about these little things. These things will not lead us anywhere. Because what they agreed to, and what we agreed to in the interim agreement, was that they could go on building Iraq. They are constructing Iraq right now, Iraq. The plant at Iraq right now. They have not fueled it. But what happened in terms of Israel, what happened with Iraq, the plant in Iraq, I-R-A-Q, was before they fueled it, Israel felt the need to attack. So the most urgent need to attack for Israel will be if they actually begin to fuel the plant at Arak, A-R-A-Q. And if they begin to do that, it will be irreversible because you can't easily attack a plant that's fueled. Because then you're going to spread the nuclear stuff all over the region. Yes.
Oh, thank you. Some of the policy planning after World War I contemplated an autonomous Kurdistan. Of course, that didn't happen. It seemed like it could be a good idea, and it seems like it would help to destabilize Iran. So what do you think about that?
I like anything that would help to destabilize Iran.
What do you think about a separate Kurdistan?
I think we should signal our willingness to go down that road if Iran doesn't change its policies in a fundamental manner. I think that is a very threatening thing for them. They actually, you know, went to Berlin to kill a bunch of Iranian Kurds in the very famous attack. They machine gunned them to death in a restaurant in Berlin. Mykonos was the name of the restaurant. And the German court convicted half of the Iranian National Security Council. They convicted Rafsanjani. They convicted a number of people who were involved in authorizing that murder of those four Iranian Kurds. They were very concerned about the potential. Over 10% of Iranians are Kurds. Over 10%. It's a very substantial number, and they're tough people. My mother is a Kurd. I can tell you, she's 99. She's still alive. And she used to tell me as a little boy that her mother rode side saddle on their farm in Kirkuk with a rifle at her side. So I'm telling you, these Kurds, if we should use them, they can be helpful to us. Is that good enough, Pat, or what? Good. One more.
Perhaps we maybe to a happier level. Do you see the United States doing what's right in, what is it, 2 years, 2 months, and a day? Get another Ronald Reagan-type president?
Not with Elizabeth Warren.
Well, yeah, that's right, and I pretty much have given up. I think that the president might not sign an agreement, and that would be a good thing. That in itself would be a good policy. So that would be a good development. But I'm not very hopeful about the change in 2 years. The bottom line of what I'm telling you is not a partisan presentation. Every administration since Carter, every administration has failed to use pressure against this regime in Iraq. Every administration. And in the last election, I tried mightily to write some talking points for our candidate, the Republican candidate for president, and actually had a Q&A for him that would have been usable in his debate with Obama on the Iranian issue, where I had him, and I know this got to his team, where I had him say that no, his policy would not be the same as Obama's policy vis-a-vis Iran, that he would put more pressure on the Iranian government, and that he essentially would adopt a more aggressive policy vis-a-vis the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps in particular. And you saw the answer that he gave in the debate. He literally agreed with Obama that he would have the same policy on Iran that Obama had. And it was, I think it was a totally disastrous answer, because the American people wanted to see a difference between Obama and our candidate, and they didn't see any. So, Patty, let's hope for a better candidate.